behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
Ben, today we've got a topic. It's another kind of a biography piece, I guess, on someone who's really interesting in the world of racing.
Mm-hmm.
And a character that maybe you heard his name, but you didn't really know a whole lot about the guy himself. And today we're going to describe the man himself.
Yes, and that man is Frank Curtis with a K.
Yeah. And you might know him better as Frank Curtis of Curtis Craft or, from midget racing.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, Frank Curtis is a little bit anomalous in the story of racing in that he is not known as a race car driver.
No, that's right. He's in fact, he's got a couple of awards that we want to talk about later, but he was inducted into some Hall of Fame. I don't know how to say this. I guess maybe he's a member of the Hall of Fame, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, in one case, he's the only non-driver to be inducted. So, when we get to his awards, later in the show, that's kind of like an interesting side note, I guess, is that, of everybody in the Hall of Fame for that particular genre, he's the only non-driver that's ever been inducted. So,
yeah.
Interesting stuff.
It's definitely saying something. But as always, let's start at the beginning. Frank Curtis is born in Colorado in a town called Crested Butte, right?
Mm-hmm.
In January of 1908.
Yeah, that's right. And he's born to a family that, well, his family came from Croatia, I think you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
right? Where his father was a jeweler.
Mm-hmm.
So he did a lot of precision metal work. And when he came to the United States, he became a blacksmith, which kind of makes sense, I guess, working with metal again. A little bit more crude, I guess, in that, he's working with, building horseshoes and things like that.
Sure, building iron implements.
Yeah, and one exciting thing that he did that Frank Jr. Jumped on right away was, of course, his father is Frank Sr. He jumped on right away was that, people were starting to bring automobiles into his blacksmith shop.
Right. And this makes sense if we think about the time in 1908, early days of the automobile. It makes sense that you would take a car, or I think they may even still call them horseless carriages or something at that time.
They did.
To a blacksmith, to a someone with a forge.
A forge, maybe. How about that? An anvil and a hammer.
There we go.
And a really hot fire. And he would work on not only automobiles, because mm-hmm. those were kind of the rare occurrence, but it was mostly horse
buggy.
And that type of thing. The, horseshoes, like we mentioned, and, mm-hmm. Any kind of mechanical hardware that, the buggies required. And of course, Frank was right there, and Frank Jr. was right there
mm-hmm.
with him. And he learned along the way, how to work with things, how to fabricate metals, how to make things, look the way he wanted them to look, right?
Right, yes. And this is a skill that leads to what could fairly be called an obsession.
Yeah, but you know what? He's really young at this point because the family, it wasn't until 1922
mm-hmm.
when the family moved to Los Angeles, California. And in 1922, just to give you an idea, Frank Jr., he's only 14 at this point. So he's got this early obsession. It's prior to the time when he's 14 when he really mm-hmm. gets involved with cars. And in 1922, when they do move to L.A., he decides to He lies about his age, Ben.
Yes, to get a job at Don Lee Cadillac.
Yeah, which is really kind of cool. And he gets in as a fabricator. And, he gets in early, like a body shop guy, I guess, is probably the better way to say that.
Yeah.
And again, still really early on, 1922, think about the Cadillacs in 1922, Ben. How cool would that be to work with those when you're 14 years old?
Beautiful.
Really, really cool.
There's no way he could afford one, though. His first car was actually a Model T from 1916.
Yeah, and the funny thing is they realized early on, and this kid's really young, and they don't know it. He's kind of snowballing him, right?
He's
snowing them over. I don't know how you say that. What's the term for that?
Pulling wool over their eyes.
That's a better way to say it. He's pulling the wool over the eyes of the boss, right? So he's 14, and they say, you've got a real knack for this body work. We're going to have you work on a special car for us. And he builds something. He starts working on, they have midget car bodies that they're working on. Now, this is a really important move or step in the whole this whole process. And he Ooh. Actually builds another car for them as well. Those were the race cars, of course. He also builds another car for them that I think listeners will appreciate if they look it up. It's called the 1937 Curtis Tommy Lee Special.
Oh, yes.
And this is the boss's car, really.
Ooh.
He's building a new body for a Cadillac for his boss. And it's a really interesting design, but it looks like the Auburn Cord design of the day, which was that boat tail speedster type vehicle, and he made a Cadillac look like that. So, you know, you can tell that this guy's really talented. He knows what he's doing, and he's very, very young.
Mm-hmm. And let's just think again about the amount of skill, the level of skill, rather, required to modify a Cadillac.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's 1937 at that point, so he's a little bit older. You know, he's definitely, gone through the ranks, I guess, in the body shop there at the Cadillac business, right?
Right. By this point, he's been fabricating for more than a decade.
And what he's doing is he's working on these midget car bodies for, you know, he's reworking these bodies, I guess, for the Don Lee's team.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally thinks to himself, as many entrepreneurial businessmen do,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to do this on my own. I'm going to make my own company and do this, you know, for my own profit, for my own reasons. And that's exactly what he did. And that's when he founded the company that they called Curtis Craft.
Right, and that's Curtis Craft with two K's, like Frank Curtis's last name and Craft, the cheese company. So as you said, Scott, late 1930s, he's building his own midget car chassis, which is just the term for the vehicles, just to be clear.
Oh, boy.
Oh, you think I'm too sensitive?
No, that's okay. I mean, when you say we're midget racing, I don't think that's what we're picturing, really, but
right.
Who knows?
Well, I just want to.
Let's cover all bases, right?
Yeah.
How about that?
All right.
So in 1939, now he's already building these midget car chassis in the 1930s. And in 1939, he makes his first trip to the Indianapolis 500. And while he's there, some guys pick him up because they know what he's there for. You know, he's a fabricator.
Right.
So he's there, you know, for business, I guess. And they pick him up and they have him rework a few of the race car bodies that were used in the Indianapolis 500. And of course, you know, he loves this. You know, this is exactly what he was there to do. So by 1941, which is just 2 years later, he builds and enters his first Indy car into competition in the Indy 500. And this is back in 1941.
Mm-hmm.
Now the success in Indy won't happen until later, but, you know, there's a few other things he does along the way, like in the late 1940s, where he's still building Indy cars. Don't get me wrong.
The whole time.
Yeah, the whole time he's still building Indy cars. But he starts building these fiberglass body sports cars in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And he's doing this in Glendale, California.
Right. And this is like 48 or 49 to about mid-1950s.
Yeah, mid-1950s. So he's a busy guy at this point because the IndyCar thing has got him really, really wrapped up. And 1949, like we mentioned, that's the year before something really impressive happened because in 1950 was the year that the driver of one of his cars won the Indy 500 for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big deal to be the chassis builder for a car that won the Indianapolis 500. That was 1950, and it was Johnny Parsons. And can I mention something about Johnny? I just feel like I think it's something we have to talk about just briefly.
Now, let's do a sidebar.
All right. Now, Johnny Parsons, he wasn't a particularly winning driver, I guess. I mean, he won lots of races along the way, but he never won any big championships or anything like that. But he did win the Indy 500. I'm sorry, he did win one championship in 1949. He won the AAA championship, which I want to mention in just a minute, AAA championship car season. But he has the distinction, Johnny Parsons does, of being the only Indianapolis 500 winner to have his name misspelled on the BorgWarner trophy.
That's a dubious distinction,
now,
Scott.
I know it is. You know, that's the big trophy that they always trot out, you know, that has the faces carved in and has every winner from 1911 all the way through today.
Uh-huh.
He's the only one on that entire trophy that has his name misspelled on there because he has an unusual spelling. Now, the silversmiths, they carved in Johnny as we probably would think it is, like J-O-H-N-N-Y.
Okay.
Johnny Parsons spells his name J-O-H-N-N-I-E. So you could see the mistake there. I mean, it's an easy mistake to make.
It's understandable.
Well, you think they would check something like that before carving it into silver and putting it on an eternal trophy.
Yeah, yeah. I would think, having never been a trophy maker, but.
Well, I guess. You know, one quick thing before we move on,
because this
kind of goes along with the Johnny Parsons thing. Because I mentioned that he did win one championship, and that was the 1949 AAA championship car season.
Mm-hmm.
And AAA actually does refer to the AAA that we think of today as the road service. The American Automobile Association is what it used to be called. It was founded in 1902, but the original purpose of that whole thing was to improve roads and highways and things like that. It was founded by, I think it was nine motor clubs in, I think it was in the Chicago area, like in the north, I suppose, because I think there were clubs from New Jersey in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
There was something like 1,500 members, but they also became a race sanctioning body in the early 1900s, and not a lot of people will know that. So
yeah, I'm one of the people who didn't know that.
Early, like in 1902, so the year they're founded, they actually were the sanctioning body that covered the Vanderbilt Cup, which was an international automobile race held in Long Island. It's mm-hmm. a famous race. I mean,
yeah.
I think a lot of people have heard of the Vanderbilt
sure.
Cup. And they actually were sponsors of the Indy 500 through the 1950s, which is important for this because that's the tie-in with Frank Curtis and Curtis Craft.
Right.
And I think it was after the Le Mans disaster in 1955 that they decided that it was kind of it was time for them to kind of back away from racing sanctioning, which is probably a smart move on their part. And not that they were involved with that. I'm just saying that it was time to back away from it and that they wanted to prioritize their goals. You know, it was about highways and it was about improving transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And then they brought it back around in, I think it was 2005 or 2006, with a NASCAR sponsorship. So they're kind of back into it again a little bit, you know, kind of
sure.
putting their toe in the water, I guess.
That's probably a great way to say it. Let's talk just a little bit about Curtis Craft.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one thing that a lot of people might not know about this is that when Curtis Craft was created, when Frank Curtis made this, it wasn't the only company he would make in his lifetime. I just want to put that on the radar. Curtis Craft, the company, made over 500 midget cars, but they also made kits, Scott.
Yeah, they made a lot of kits, didn't they? Even more kits than they made cars.
Yeah, which is, at first glance, that sounds kind of strange for a racing company, doesn't it?
I guess so, maybe. I mean, because then you're allowed to send it, you can ship them out and the teams are allowed to do with it what they want, right? They've got a good basis, a good starting point. So he made something like, I mean, total, it was nearly 1,200 midget kits, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, kits and cars combined, I suppose.
Right, you know, all like, together, but the majority of those were kits.
Yeah, so not the ready-to-race type. I mean, I think there were like 550 complete cars that they built at the factory.
Yeah. And they did pretty well. They performed pretty well because the chassis had a smaller version of what's called the Offenhauser motor.
Mm-hmm.
And you can check out the National Midget Auto Racing Hall of Fame, and they have nothing to say but praise about this engine.
Exactly. And the Offenhauser motor was the one that was paired with the car, the Indy car. And the Indy car, just to give you like a kind of a wrap up on the Indy car.
Yeah.
Cause this happened throughout the 1950s. So 1950 all the way through 63.
Mm-hmm.
He built something like 120 Indy 500 cars in that time period. So 120 cars came out of the Chris Craft factory, and five of those cars, Ben, it wasn't just Parsons that won.
Oh, yeah.
There were five winners. He won it five times, which is a big deal to win it even once, really. But that Offenhauser engine, that's a winning combination, I guess, is what they say. They said it was an unbeatable combination later.
Yeah. And they said this because if you think about it, midget car is going to have a higher power to weight ratio than an Indy car with the same engine.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very, very lightweight car and it's a strong engine. And I'm sure that, you know, they had that thing tuned right to the maximum. So it's the formula, I guess, is that it's a very, very strong engine, you know, maybe just a couple of gears.
Yeah.
And very, very lightweight. So it's a brutal machine to drive. It's really, really fast. And even today, you know, the sprint cars that we see today, cause, you know, he built more than just, I want to list a couple of things that he built, because it wasn't just the cars that we've mentioned so far. I mean, he built midget cars.
Right.
And now, just to give you an idea, these midget cars now, which they still race, they have something like 300 to 400 horsepower and they weigh 1,000 pounds. So they're extremely fast, extremely small. But they're often like dirt track cars. You know, they're often run on dirt tracks at smaller venues. And, also quarter midgets, which were the same thing for younger kids to race. I had a friend in the late 70s, early 80s that raced quarter midgets.
Oh, cool.
Which was really, really cool to watch. It was such a small track, but it was really neat that my friend had what I thought was a real race car. You know, mm-hmm. It really was. It's like a go-kart that's a little taller. And way faster, it seemed. They were really quick. And then there are also sprint cars that they built.
Mm-hmm.
They built, sports cars that we mentioned, which were in complete car form. Just a few of those, not really many at all. And then he also built kit car sports cars, which, you know, were for the do-it-yourselfers that would like to do it out in the garage. Indy cars that we mentioned, and boy, one last note. Can I mention one last note on Indy cars? And
yeah,
then,
yeah.
You know, I'll just say Indy cars and Formula One cars, but the Indy car thing, this is, I promise it's the last thing on this. Well, I think it is.
Oh, no, man. It's too interesting. Don't limit yourself.
Here's how prevalent they were in the 1950s, the Curtis Craft cars. 24 out of the 33 starting cars at the Indy 500 races were Curtis Craft built cars in these following years, 1952, 53, 54, and 55. 24, Ben, out of 33 cars that started were Curtis Craft cars, were Curtis mm-hmm. Craft chassis cars. That's incredible. That's a huge number.
It's nearly a monopoly.
It's almost that way. That's right.
Yeah. And, let's talk about some of his, specific stuff, like the Curtis sports car.
Sure.
In 1949. Pretty cool. That's called the first sports car that Curtis built in sort of maybe not production quality or quantity, but more than one. And, it was the cover car for the very first issue of Motor Trend magazine.
How cool is that? That's kind of a neat little fact, right? I mean, it's an easy place for people to go and look at it and be able to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at a photo of it right now. It's an interesting design. I mean, if it's this drop top that I'm looking at,
yeah.
I think that's the one.
I think you're right.
Very, very cool. Which one is this? Is this the 500S, I think, maybe? Is that the one?
The 500S is 1953.
Okay, so I have my models mixed up, but he built a few different models, like the 500S, right. The 500M, I think, mm-hmm. was the kit car version of that.
Right.
So a lot of different sports cars, and people really enjoyed them because they were lightweight. They were made of this sort of new, they called it glass fiber, but it was really, we call it fiberglass now.
The newfangled thing in automotive, fiberglass.
Sort of like that, yeah. It was really interesting setups. I mean, and he could do with it what he wanted because it's his own company.
Right. And let's take a note here to think about the engineering innovation that fiberglass was. This is a huge win for material science at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fiberglass is sort of this miracle material that you can mold into almost whatever shape you wish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he had it was kind of like a blue sky operation for him. He could do whatever he wanted with this thing. I mean, of course, he's very, very skilled at metal forming as well.
Right.
It's just this could be done a lot quicker, you know, with molds where they spray in or lay in the different layers of fiberglass. And we've talked about that before, I think, haven't we? Like,
yeah.
How to produce fiberglass bodies or something similar anyway.
Right. Well, we've talked about carbon fiber, which has some similarities.
Yeah, it's very, very similar. It's just different materials that you lay into that mold, but,
right.
And different curing processes, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, this was a perfect example of the way to use something brand new, a new material.
Mm-hmm.
And it's lightweight. And, you know, it's everything that he wanted because it made his road cars extremely fast.
Now the 500S, speaking of extremely fast, has some really interesting stuff about it. It's, design heavily borrows from Indy Roadsters.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a 5.8-liter Cadillac engine. Two Curtis Craft 500s were actually at the 1955 12 Hours of Sebring.
That is really cool. So he's taking the race car design and put it into your hands on the street, really. A similar design, I suppose, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of the technologies, I would trust a car that was built by Curtis Craft. I think that, you know, that guy knows what he's doing, obviously.
Yeah. Well, one thing that we would be remiss not to mention, the Curtis Craft with that Cadillac engine I talked about.
Yeah.
It didn't finish due to engine problems.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean.
I'm sorry. But the other one had a 5.2 liter Lincoln engine, and it came in 13th overall, but first in its class.
Not bad.
Not bad.
Not bad at all. So he's doing well in the world of racing, and, you know, he's got this, this production car thing going on as well. So, you know, he's got his hands in a lot of different things, and we're getting to about, what, the late 1950s. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know what? There's one last thing on his, production cars.
Yeah.
He sold the design, I think.
Oh, yeah.
To a guy named, Frank Muntz. Is that it?
Madman Muntz.
Is it Frank Muntz? I think it's Muntz.
Hang on. Let me grab it here because I know the guy you are talking about.
Yeah. I think they call him Madman Muntz, and he designed a car he used the Curtis Craft vehicle as a basis for his design of the Muntz Jet, right? I think they called it the Muntz Road Jet.
Yeah, he made about 17 of these vehicles, and then he sold the license to Madman Muntz, and then Muntz used it to take it, the design airborne.
That's it. Now, Muntz was into everything. He was into electronics, I think, wasn't he? He would do like car stereo systems, televisions, I think all kinds of different things. Automobiles, of course.
Well, he was, Scott, he was mad.
Yeah, there's some funny photos of that guy. I think he would do these kind of wacky commercials.
Yeah.
He was kind of a nut, but I mean, thus the name, right?
Kind of a showman, I think.
He definitely was. And you know what? I bet he dressed well also. And I would bet that Madman Muntz was a gadget guy as well.
Oh, sure.
I mean, he's an electronics guy. He's taking cars, you know, production cars and reworking them, kind of these one-offs.
Yeah.
He seemed like that kind of guy. I mean, look at any of these photos or the stuff that he had done, you know, any of the, television commercials. I don't know if you can find any of those online or not, but, just the photographs of the guy alone are really hilarious. You should check it out.
Yeah. We might even, do a little blog post on Madman Muntz if you want to check it out on carstuffshow.com.
Yeah. That'll be coming up. I'm sure that we can find some new and exciting info about Madman Muntz, but, so we're getting to like the late '50s, right?
Right. We left off on 1955. And then something big happened in 1956.
Yeah, he left his own company, right?
Yeah.
But he went out to what? To do something worthwhile.
He went out to start his another company with a very similar name.
Yeah, very, very similar name. But, you know, what was the new name?
Frank Curtis Company as opposed to Curtis Craft.
Okay, well, you know what this amounts to is that somebody was interested in buying his business.
Yeah.
And in 1956, he sold the midget car side of the business to, in the late 1950s, 1956. And, they probably gave him a lot of money and he said, yeah, I'll do that. And they said, we want to keep the name. And he said, that's not a problem. I'll just start a new company that's very, very similar in name.
Right.
And does basically the same thing.
Right, yeah. By the end of that year, by the end of 1956, Frank Curtis has designed a new midget roadster, and there are 14 cars getting built for the 57 Indy.
Yeah, so he's right back on his game, right? Because we mentioned that he built cars, I think, all the way until 1963. I think that was in 63, that was when the last Indy car was at the Frank Curtis Company in their shop. So, you know, he continued what he was doing right from the very beginning. He just kind of branched out. He probably got a pretty nice payday to sell out his original company.
Oh, yes, sir.
Which he did, and, you know, just moved on with something new. So he didn't really feel like he had to be tied to that first company to do what he does.
Right. Not necessarily risk averse. They, Frank Curtis Company also built, 1/4 midgets and they made go-karts. And here's something interesting. I don't know if you heard about this, but, he built spare parts for Lockheed.
Yeah, you know, I did. And that's why the 1963 date is key, because he quit working on the Indy cars at the shop there in 1963, and in August of 1963, that's when Lockheed Corporation came to him with this idea to build parts. And now it says start carts and spares.
Right.
What are start carts and spares? Do you happen to know? I don't know if I know what that is.
I think that the start cart is the something that's used to help the SR-71 Blackbird get off the ground.
Now, isn't that cool? Now, he's working on, and this is 1963, he's working on the SR-71 Blackbird project for Lockheed. And that's a huge deal. I mean, even if you've got a contract for a small part of that, which he did, the start carts and spares, and I don't know what exactly that means.
Right, and it was probably classified at the time, too.
I would think so, because it wasn't really until, you know, I want to say the 1980s when we really started to hear about the SR-71.
Right,
and
yeah.
That's when it kind of became public knowledge, I guess. Maybe there was mention of it a little bit ahead of that, but I really didn't hear about it until the 1980s. In fact, the late 1980s.
We know it was a UFO when it was first flying around in the 60s and early 70s.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, he's got this big project, and that actually kind of carried him through the 1980s. I mean, it went right through until the project was ended. So,
well, his company kept working through the 80s.
I guess he retired. He did. He retired in the late 1960s, right?
Yeah, he retired in 1968, and he passed the company on to his son, Arlen.
Yeah, his son Arlen, who kind of picked up the family business. His dad was age 60, and I guess he thought that was time to get out. So, you know, people retired a lot earlier, it seemed like, in the past. 60 was the day you're out, you know.
No kidding. But also, people live a lot longer now.
That's true. That's another way to look at it, Ben. You're right. So, you know, Arlen not only was working on the SR-71 Blackbird stuff for Lockheed,
yeah,
he was also starting to develop some stuff for drag racing and water skiing. So he's got this kind of this watercraft side of the business that he's developing now as well. In fact, they started to work on the what's called the world's fastest prop-driven boat.
Yes, and set a world record that I think, if I'm not, I checked this before we went on air, I don't think it's been beaten yet.
I would doubt that it has, because the record is 229 miles per hour, and the driver, it wasn't Arlen, it was, you know, Arlen built the boat, of course.
Right.
The driver was Eddie Hill, and I think Eddie Hill has other speed records as well, so, or did at one time, so... this world's fastest prop-driven boat is still held by, I believe it's still held by, we're going to have to double-check this, but
right.
Still held by, you know, a boat that was developed and built by the Frank Curtis Company.
Mm-hmm.
And then it wasn't long after that that they decided to sell the boat business and concentrate entirely on the SR-71 project, which may have been a mistake, right?
Well, you know, the SR-71 program was retired in 1989.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so business kind of dried up for the Frank Curtis Company. But his son, kind of maybe one of the last few things we want to mention here, his son started to rebuild some of his dad's old cars, which is kind of a nice pastime, I guess. I don't know if you can really make a whole business out of that, but I think he did.
Well, yeah, he started limited production with a few, some selected or curated models of cars and parts that Frank Curtis Jr. had built.
So it wasn't like he was taking, you know, like I can find two cars out there and I'm going to restore and build those and sell them and that's my business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was more like he's going to reproduce the parts. He's going to reproduce some of the makes and models that his dad was building and, you know, say like, I'm going to offer some of the stuff that my dad offered back in the day.
Yes. And, let's see, you know, Scott, this is kind of a sidebar, but I have this information about midget car racing. I just want to put out there.
You know what, tell you what, that's not a bad thing. Cause, I guess, how about the last thing we do here is we mentioned yeah. that, you know, I guess what you would really recognize him for was that he was the best midget car builder in the world, really. I
True.
Mean, we can outright say that. I mean,
yeah, categorically.
I think that everybody would agree with that.
Yeah.
5-time Indy 500 winner as a builder, fabricator, designer, sports car builder. I'm just kind of an all-around guy. We can mention awards later, but what's the midget car thing?
Okay. So midget car racing. This comes in. It, you'll find people who say it officially begins in August of 33, but I think there's some variance there. So let's just say early 30s. The first governing association was the Midget Auto Racing Association, but I felt like I was remiss in this part of our show because I didn't say the general stats of a midget car. They generally have 300 to 400 horsepower, but they only weigh 1,000 pounds.
Whoa. Lightweight.
Yeah, lightweight. So that's what we were saying when we were saying the power to weight ratio. Of course, for anybody who is really thinking about the numbers here, that makes them dangerous. There's not really a way to get around saying that.
No, they're definitely dangerous.
But, you know, now in modern day, they have roll cages, and they have the usual safety concerns that you would see in any other legit racing.
I guess when we say dangerous, we mean potentially dangerous in that they're fast, they're lightweight, they like to roll over on turns if you go a little too fast, if you know what I mean. They like
yeah.
to flip the sprint cars. I think it's sprint cars that I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Those are the ones with the giant wings on top.
Exactly.
They look like the World of Outlaw cars, I think is what they call them occasionally. That's a series name.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say it's like the Flying Nun cap on them.
Oh, you know, like the, those are called Wimples.
Yeah, okay. I've never heard it called Wimples. That's interesting.
I think that's the name for like the Nun's Habit.
Oh, I thought you were saying the racing series.
No. That I think that's the name for the Nun headgear.
Really? So it's like a Wimple hat on top of a sprint car is what it looks like.
And, yes.
Okay. I don't
what
like.
What a good idea. How could that ever go wrong?
I don't like to call it Wimple. I'm just going to say the giant wing on top.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
But yeah, you'll see those things roll and flip and they get mm-hmm. up, you know, they'll launch themselves in the air as high as the fence. You know, so they're dangerous in that way, but a lot of times these guys just get out and walk away from their accidents.
Well, yeah. And a sports car is like any other powerful force. You know, if you want your car to respect you, you have to respect it. As cliche as that might sound.
Sure. In the wrong hands.
There we go.
That's maybe the way to say it.
With great horsepower comes great responsibility.
That's right. All right. So any more on
that's it. Yeah,
midgets or quarter midgets or go-karts or any of the other stuff? How about Curtis Craft boats?
Oh, man. Okay, go for it. But my caveat is that we should strongly consider exploring some of these other topics in newer episodes.
Absolutely, we should. Because it seems like there's a lot of spinoff material here, and I think some of this is ripe for a full podcast. Now, the last thing that I'd like to mention, I think, today is that, you know, we talked about some awards that Frank Curtis has won throughout his career, right?
Yes.
And a lot of these come later in the game because, you know, of course, I mean, throughout your history, I guess, when you're doing these types of things, you're so involved with what you're doing and you're really building your name, you're building your reputation.
Sure.
And he has that reputation we mentioned as being, a lot of people say, the best midget car builder ever that's ever been on planet Earth. That's a very, pretty bold statement, I know, but that's true. Well, just to give you an idea, he's got three pretty significant awards to his name. He was inducted into the National Sprint Car Hall of Fame in 1994. He was inducted into the Motorsports Hall of Fame in 1999. And then we mentioned this one early on. In 1986, he was inducted into the National Midget Auto Racing Hall of Fame. And that's the one that's really impressive because, I mean, they're all impressive, but
right.
He's the first non-driver to ever be inducted into that particular Hall of Fame, the National Midget Auto Racing Hall of Fame. So that is a significant award for that one. I mean, it's not easy to get into that. And that shows that, you know, they had great respect for him and what he did.
Yeah, because he is literally instrumental, one of the cornerstones of that racing. Scott, if you want to close out, I've got some listener mail.
Sure, let's do it.
Okay, this listener mail comes to us from Wayne R. Now, we've been getting a lot of email recently from Australia. Australian listeners.
Wonder why the uptick on Australian listeners.
I don't know, but I love it. And that's why we're learning to correctly pronounce the names of Australian
that's
towns.
That's right. We had a little pronunciation key sent to us a couple weeks ago.
Yes. And you can, if you haven't heard that episode, do check it out. So Wayne writes to us and says, "Hi, Scott and Ben. I listened to the episode on the history of trucks some time ago, and it's been on my mind since. Don't worry, Scott. We're not in trouble." He said, "Toward the end of the episode, you guys hinted at the possibility of a sequel based on similar or smaller size pickup trucks or cars, like the El Camino or the Ranchero, etc."
Ooh, we love those.
Yeah, and he said that episode was also going to feature Ben's El Camino story, which I guess we've hyped a little. He has a suggestion. Wayne says, "My suggestion for such an episode is to look into the very similar Australian Ute."
Oh, yeah, you know what? I know exactly what he's talking about. Is that the Holden car?
Yeah, he goes, "Here in Australia, any vehicle with a front cab and tray behind is still classed as a ute, including pickup trucks. And manufacturers such as Ford and Holden have been producing the traditional Australian ute since the 30s. And he's got some great information on the ute. And, Wayne, you did something very flattering. Scott, in his email, and I wish I could read the whole thing, he's got a quick search of my own on HowStuffWorks.com brought up an article on the 5759 Ranchero, which is said to have used the Aussie Ute as inspiration. In the same article, the 59 El Camino is also said to have followed the Ranchero concept."
Interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah, those are really cool vehicles. I like, you know, the functionality of them, I guess. You know, that it's kind of it's a car when you want it to be, it's a truck when you want it to be. They're really cool.
Yes, and now Wayne goes on with some more information that I think we could save for our upcoming small size pickup truck or pickup vehicle podcast.
Well, let's hang on to it then.
Okay, because he's got a couple follow-up emails. Oh, and one other thing he says, he's got some links for us to check out here too. Wayne from Melbourne ended with saying, "Thank you for the hours of enjoyment."
Oh, very nice.
And congratulate me on a new podcast. Well, thank you, Wayne. We hope that you stay tuned because we have both your emails out here and act surprised when you get mentioned on our upcoming episode. As a matter of fact, gather your friends around and pretend that it just randomly came on and say, "Well, you know, I'm kind of a big deal in the States, guys."
Yeah, that's me. I'm Wayne of the Car Stuff Podcast.
Yeah, introduce yourself that way. Let's see how far it gets you.
It'll probably not get you too far.
Oh, well, you never know. We'll see. We'll see. We're not making any promises.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. But thanks, Wayne. That's a good note. And I'm going to check out some of those links that you sent as well.
Yes. And while we're doing that, we are going to bid you adieu, bid you good day. We are heading out to do some research, and we hope that you have enjoyed our podcast on the life of Frank Curtis Jr., as well as some history of midget car racing. If you have any questions, you can find us on Facebook, where we Car Stuff HSW. You can also drop us a line on Twitter. And, oh, wait, that's right, we have a website.
Yeah, we've got a really cool website. It's carstuffshow.com, and you can get the podcast there. You can look at some of the blog posts that we've been putting up there. Mm-hmm. There's videos. Mm-hmm. You can learn all about Ben and I if you really want to do that, see some photos. Just a lot of stuff to kind of have fun with on the site.
Mm-hmm.
Good place to go.
And it's a place where you can also tell us if you just want our opinion about some stuff, then, you know, hit us up. We might even write a blog post for you.
Yeah, that's right.
Again, no promises. But if you'd like to send us some more information, send us some cool car stories, especially, oh, man, if you have a midget racer.
That would be great. And send a photo. That's really cool. I'd really be interested to see someone who has, you know, quarter midget photos or sprint car photos, or if you own one of these Curtis Craft cars, like a street car. That'd be really cool.
Oh, man.
They're pretty rare.
They are pretty rare, so it's a diamond in the rough situation. But if you do, do not hesitate to drop us a line. Our email address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.